this is where women, this is, I say women because women are the smarter species. They typically are aware that there's something wrong, and they often will talk about it, at least, if not seek advice.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an entrepologist and naturopathic doctor, I work with entrepreneurs and go-getters to put them into their optimal state of health so they can change the world. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it, that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Bradley Bush. Dr. Bush is a naturopathic physician practicing in Minnesota. In his practice, he focuses on adrenal health, sleep, and Lyme disease. And today, we had the opportunity to talk about these factors in a really particular context. We talked about optimal neuroendocrine balance for entrepreneurs and go-getters. We talked about the reason that the digestive system is the root of everything to do with your health. And we also looked at why it is you can't sleep. Until my personal coughing fit interrupted the discussion, we were also dabbling into the epidemic of Lyme disease, and I'm hoping we can salvage some of it for you. This episode is jam-packed. It is speaking highly and specifically to entrepreneurs and go-getters, and you're going to get a lot out of it. Here is Dr. Bush. Dr. Bush, it is a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I had the opportunity to hear you speak in the last few weeks, and was just so enamored with obviously your depth of knowledge, but its relevancy to people, in particular my population of entrepreneurs. I was really so excited that you were able to join us today.
Thank you, Megan, and thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited to kind of share what I do and how I work with people with your group.
Yeah, so I want to jump into something you were talking about first before we get into your background and how you got here. But one of the things you said at this conference, and you correct me if I am getting this wrong, but you noted that 10% of depression is caused by inflammation. Let's start there, because I think most people believe that depression is this chemical imbalance in the brain. It didn't occur to them that inflammation would be a mechanism for it. Is this a completely new theory? Like, let's just open up this conversation right off the bat.
Sure. So, Megan, inflammation is a reaction of the immune system. And when you think of inflammation, you think of a finger that's swollen or an eye that's swollen, whatever it may be. And of course, there's pain associated with it. It may be hot, maybe red colored. But when we're talking about inflammation, we're talking about on a molecular level, certain types of pro-inflammatory cytokines are released. And this is often as a reaction to something in your immune system. The number one cause of depression in the world is depression of chronic disease, AKA chronic inflammation. When inflammation occurs, it inherently affects the nervous system in ways that includes the decrease in the synthesis of certain neurotransmitters like serotonin, like norepinephrine, like dopamine, that impact not only how we feel, but also the stability of our mood.
Okay, so I promise we're going to get to talking about your background, but what's so interesting there, when you talk about these other neurotransmitters, and we are talking about depression here, but if we're looking at talking about dopamine and its influence on motivation, if we're talking about norepinephrine and its influences on adrenals and stress pathways, do different people have different susceptibilities that this inflammation is going to manifest for them? Are some people not able to motivate themselves because of the influence inflammation is having on dopamine pathways, for example?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what I always tell patients, you know, you came to the party. You came to the adrenal fatigue party. You came to the depression, the anxiety, the insomnia party, whatever party you're off to. You've got there, but guess what? It took you a little while to get there, and there's always baggage that you had prior to your departure to that party. That baggage, those are predispositions, whether it be environmental, i.e. Maybe having allergies to airborne particulate matter, to dust, dander, to foods, whether it be past infections, whether it be genetic inability to manufacture certain vitamins or nutrients in the body. All these predispositions creates that beautiful mosaic of manifestation of disease that we all kind of experience. For example, and this is very key to the topic of adrenal fatigue and depression and anxiety, insomnia, these oftentimes are triggered by the same changes in people on a biochemical level. So your hormones, your neurotransmitters may change in ways that match. One person may have a change that creates anxiety. The same person may have a chemical change that looks exactly like that person, but they have insomnia or depression. Another one just might be horribly fatigued. All different people manifesting the same biochemical differences, what's different is us. We're all different. We all process things a little bit uniquely, both biochemically and psychologically.
Now, I'm saying this sarcastically, but are you suggesting that we should actually be treating individuals as opposed to looking at things en masse? And, you know, I'll use that as a segue, because if I don't ask you about your background, we're gonna just go down this rabbit hole of really cool topics. You're a naturopathic physician practicing in Minnesota. By very virtue of that background, I know this because I'm an ND as well. We treat the individual. Tell me how you came to follow this path and where you think it's taking you.
Well, I started this path in a very not so direct way. So my passion was animal behavior, genetics, biochemistry. I got a degree in research zoology and chemistry. My passion led me to apply to a bunch of master's programs for developmental neurobiology. I took a little side route, spent some time volunteering, ended up in Haiti for 6 weeks volunteering at a orphanage and helping write grants for a co-op. When I was there, I sort of had this realization that, you know, this world probably need another researcher. Although researchers are very important, I decided I wanted to help more people. And due to my belief that people should treat root causes and not just sweep problems under the rug for later, I take that in just not only my medical philosophy, but also my personal philosophy. We should dig a little deeper, find root causes, and address those. That's what led me to natural medicine, because they had the biggest open toolbox of treatments. And at the same time, they also had a big toolbox of diagnostic tools that help in interconnecting disciplines into a true diagnosis that helps you then get a better grasp on clinical problems and improve your success rate.
Right. And it looks at the body as an entire system, not these individual components. And I just think we're so aligned, and probably why we're both attracted to this this profession in the first place. I work with entrepreneurs and go-getters. So the pattern I typically see is that they push and push and push their body until their body says enough, like it can't keep up with their determination. As clinicians, we would probably label this as adrenal fatigue. Can you talk about what adrenal fatigue is? I know this is a passion of yours.
Sure. Adrenal fatigue is a wearing down of the functionality of the adrenal gland. The adrenal gland sits on top of the kidneys. It's made up of two different types of tissue, and that's very important. One part of the tissue is endocrine and is fully functions like an endocrine gland. The other part of it, the medulla or the center of the gland, is neurological tissue, and it's hardwired to the sympathetic nervous system. And because of this unique structure, this hormonal and neurological structure, the adrenal glands is a major regulator of sympathetic function and stress reaction in the body. So in the conventional medical model, you only have an adrenal problem if you do not produce any cortisol and you have the Addison's disease syndrome. This is where you don't have enough cortisol produced and could be life-threatening. It's interesting. Once again, this is what drives me crazy about conventional approach or just conservative mindsets. Just because you have a disease like Addison's doesn't necessarily mean that the world has to be black or white, either Addison's or non-Addison's. The world often lives in the gray, and this is where adrenal fatigue is. Adrenal fatigue is not where you have a non-functional adrenal gland not producing cortisol hormone, but you have an adrenal gland that is not capable to meet the physiological needs for the person. Therefore, they may not be 100% defunct. They may only be 30% functional, which puts you at a disadvantage in how you want to achieve what you want to do throughout your day.
Yeah, well, and that's just it, right? We talk about this concept of fine, right? You see your doctor, you're totally fine. And fine is a really low standard as far as I'm concerned. And all of these people we work with, what they want is they're like, I want optimal, I want amazing, I want to achieve everywhere. But your fine health is what's going to enable you to do that. Can we just dig deeper on this this adrenal concept? Because I think when people are introduced to the notion of adrenal fatigue, there's all of these light bulbs and these aha moments going off. How does this manifest for people in their everyday lives? How is the average person experiencing adrenal fatigue?
Sure. Well, adrenal fatigue has a big spectrum. So when you are in the early stage of adrenal fatigue, it's a good time for you. Physiologically, when you're in early stage adrenal fatigue, everything is firing on all cylinders. You have lots of hormones and neurotransmitters. You're in this pure fight and flight mode. And typically, this is where most entrepreneurs want to be, or they struggle to maintain because they are constantly in a driving moment. They're the drivers. They're not passive. They're not waiting for someone else to seize the moment. They're the first ones on the scene. So early in your career, that's an easy thing to do. You're driven by your life ambition. Later on, you sometimes find yourself struggling to maintain that high peak performance. So you start drinking more coffee. You start smoking cigarettes. You start downing the energy drinks. You start looking for supplements to help give you a boost. You might flip over to a medication, to amphetamines, speed, cocaine. There's nicotine pills. I mean, you name it. People keep try all their best to stay at this heightened mode, but just like the old saying goes, what goes up must come down. You can only be in this pure fight and flight mode for a period of time. When your biological clock finally ticks and you're no longer able to maintain that high peak performance level, your different neurotransmitters and hormones will start decreasing. They don't decrease all at one time. Some will decrease first than others. Typically, cortisol and epinephrine and serotonin are the first biomarkers to decrease in people. This manifests as being more tired, having more difficulty either waking up or crashing late morning. You tend to have poor quality or less quality sleep because your serotonin drops, and so you start getting easily woken from sleep, difficulty falling asleep, feeling unrested when you wake up. You may have the inability to maintain episodes of concentration or or higher output, and that's because of the lack of adrenaline and the inability for your cortisol to boost to help in dumping energy and sugar for your body to use up. And yes, you think of using energy maybe doing exercise, but mental exercise and staying mentally acute and alert, especially in a high demand situation, will suck up that glucose more than anything.
Right. I read a stat last week that said that adults make 35,000 conscious decisions a day. So it's a lot of energy that's required by our brain before we are able to be closing down at the end of the evening.
Exactly. And so when you get to this, when you get these stages, we call the mid-stage adrenal fatigue, this is where sort of the rubber meets the road for a lot of people. This is where you start getting fatigued, but yet you're feeling a little stressed out because you don't have enough of the breaks in the nervous system available. And you get the wired and tired feel. That wired and tired becomes compounded if you have even worse sleep. So you'll progressively work through this. This is where women, because women are the smarter species. They typically are aware that there's something wrong, and they often will talk about it, at least, if not seek advice. I say this in jest because men who typically see the doctor less often than a woman, they are more inclined statistically to self-medicate. And when you're stressed and you're more wired and you might not sleep well, the drug of choice typically is alcohol. And so alcohol consumption among men is much higher than female on average. And the people who tend to be more inclined to use alcohol as a self-prescription for anxiety or sleep tend to be men. And they tend to have adrenal fatigue in addition to some other predispositions.
Right. And in evaluating that, I mean, I think people are probably wanting to know, what do you do to treat this? But I suspect that as a naturopathic physician, the first thing you're going to say is, well, I want to appropriately assess what's going on. How do you assess the health of someone's adrenal system and then on a larger level, this HPA axis?
Oh, sure. The adrenal glands can be measured in a number of different ways. The most functional and what I find the most valuable assessment is a second morning urine collection for neurotransmitters, which includes the neurotransmitters of epinephrine and norepinephrine produced by the adrenal gland, and serotonin, which is a major break in that nervous system to help you adapt to stress. And then the second part of it is a four point cortisol assessment, where you collect saliva four times throughout the day, which allows you to get a diurnal or day-long measurement of cortisol activity, because it's supposed to be highest first thing in the morning, lose half of its level by afternoon, lose another 50% of its level by early evening, and then be almost close to zero at bedtime. This is the best way to functionally assess. You could also get a serum test to measure, to make sure you have cortisol levels. This test is sometimes falsely interpreted as a thumbs up that your adrenal gland is fine, because the serum testing for cortisol is really geared towards looking for tumors and Addison's disease. So it's not sensitive enough to pick up a functional dysfunction of the adrenal gland. And remember, the average person tends to have a little stress when they're being assaulted by a venipuncture needle for that blood draw. So it tends to be a little bit of a better cortisol reaction than you normally do. DHEA is often also measured and can be very important in that overall diagnosis, in addition to ruling out other things that impact the adrenal gland, your gut health, your cardiac health, your blood sugar levels, and things on that order.
Yeah, and maybe we can talk about gut health in particular, because I think this is an aha moment for a lot of my patients when we talk about the correlation between their gut health and then functionally how that impacts their adrenal glands, how that impacts their brain. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, and we'll take it back to this inflammation, right? Like leaky gut, inflammation in the gut, leaky brain. How does that work?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, it's so important to link the brain and gut together. They're not literally linked together, but when it comes to how they interact, it's impossible to separate them. And here's a case in point. The average person has maybe not the best diet in the world. In addition to that, they tend to, as we age, we tend to get more and more sensitivities to foods we eat. We tend to feel a little more bloated or have more gas. We tend to react to certain foods more often or more noticeably than you had before. Maybe your bowel movements aren't doing as well. So irritable bowel syndrome affecting a huge part of the population, constipation, diarrhea. Now, all of this thrown together, if you have gastrointestinal issues, whether it be a food allergy or sensitivity, an intestinal dysbiosis or infection, or maybe even an autoimmune condition like a Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, all of these create inflammation. And one thing to remember, inflammation is created by the immune system. 80% of your body's immune system is found in the intestines. So if you have intestinal issues, it will directly reflect in a major way to your immune system, which the immune system is so tightly interrelated with the nervous system that imbalance in the immune system leads to the imbalances in the nervous system. And when you have active inflammation being produced due to whatever gut issue you might have, that inflammation becomes chronic. That is the chronic inflammation that leads to less production of key neurotransmitters, including serotonin, which is essential for mood, for the ability to adapt to stress, the ability to have an efficient night's sleep. And it's also important for women for your ability for your estrogens to work properly in the body and to keep estrogen receptors active and mobile and serotonin receptors active and mobile in perimenopause and menopause. All very important things.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned serotonin specifically and so much of it being produced in the gut. It's always remarkable to me when women come into, and in particular I find it with women, come into my practice who are on antidepressants, how frequently there are accompanying gut issues. And those have never been addressed for these individuals. They've been put on medication to manage or try to increase their serotonin or availability of serotonin, but no one has ever stepped back to make that functional connection.
Well, and it's also important you corrected yourself that the antidepressants that are given, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors and the SNRIs, these are classification of meds that have very good function in increasing the mobilization of serotonin. But an important thing to know, especially for all the entrepreneurs out there, when you use the antidepressant, it is literally like borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. You had low levels of serotonin in your neurons. When you start the SSRI, you deplete those storage levels even further to maintain an appearance of more activity. But then in time, not only do you have that lower level of storage activity, you actually deposit less for future use as you maintain on that SSRI. You literally will cause your well to run dry further the longer you're on the SSRI. It is important that if you find relief on the one of these medications, to also continue to co-treat with precursors to make more serotonin so that, one, your level of the SSRI remains the same and doesn't have to be increased and it's more effective. Number two, as a strategy to help in addressing a root cause and help you maybe wean down off your medication in the future. And then finally, if you have lower serotonin, you already know that your ability to adapt to stress will be highly compromised. So that extra serotonin support could also be beneficial in maintaining your higher standard of workload that you are keeping yourself to.
Yeah. And in the interest of really trying to help people here, going on an SSRI or an antidepressant or whatever it happens to be, that is step one. And that might be as far as your conventional physician can take you, but this is where naturopathic medicine kind of picks up the reins and says, listen, there's 10 more steps to your recovery. Let's work on 2 through 10 together. And I think I'm hearing you say that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, the entrepreneurs that we're working with, the go-getters who are, they're out on their mission, they're pushing themselves through. A lot of them are going to be listening to this and they're going to say, okay, I'm susceptible to adrenal fatigue. How do I hedge my bets against that? What can I do on a lifestyle perspective on a daily basis to preserve the integrity of my adrenal glands? Or I think probably in their ideal world, hang out in that early stage of adrenal engagement.
Mm-hmm. Well, first off, you want to measure your activity levels to get a pulse point on where you're at. So a simple urine and saliva test is usually the first way to measure where you are at. Okay, because guess what? You will feel great in the very early stages of not adapting to stress, because you still will have all your excitatory neurotransmitters, your hormones will be elevated, but you may be bringing low serotonin to the party, and that becomes your ticking time bomb. Eventually, everything else is going to get caught up with to you, and you'll start developing symptoms. Likewise, you may already be burning out, but you just don't even know it. So it's nice to have that little a little check-in to see biologically what is going on. On top of that, is there other things going on? Now, many people will say, hey, I'm doing great. I'm wonderful. Yeah, I've had diarrhea for about 3 years. Okay, well, that's not normal. Or, yeah, I'm perfectly healthy, but I go to the bathroom twice a week. Okay, that's great, but that's not normal. At the end of the day, it's oftentimes the GI tract that is the first part of instability in the body. And that is partly because it's a very long tube that's really dark and damp, and it oftentimes is can't be regulated in any easy way. For example, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, is a condition that usually occurs 18 to 22 feet down in the small intestines. And it's not measurable in any real easy way, and you can't identify through secondary reactions that it might be occurring. And this overgrowth could eventually lead it to where you no longer do well with most foods, and you find yourself on restricted diets. You find yourself, hey, if I stay on the paleo diet or the Whole30 diet or a modified Atkins diet, I do great. As soon as I introduce other foods, I do horrible. Okay, that's a big, big warning sign. Likewise, think about your family. If you have had a lot of family members with depression, anxiety, insomnia, if you've had people with psychiatric issues, with cardiovascular problems or autoimmune problems, then you're going to be one of those people where you're going to want to monitor autoimmune activity, inflammation on a regular basis so that something that you may be predisposed to doesn't start. And with under really high stress, high stress in itself can initiate predispositions that have been handed down due to genetics to you. And that includes autoimmune issues and depression or inability to manufacture certain neurotransmitters. So these are things to be aware of. Work with a naturopathic doctor or other holistic provider to kind of like get a bigger picture, and also to make sure you're monitored on a regular basis.
Right, because taking care of your health is like your unfair secret advantage as someone who is living a life on a mission. Like, you can't wait until it falls apart. And, you know, to that end, I think one of the things that we have historically, and I feel like sometimes there's the message is starting to change, but we have undervalued recovery as an important ingredient in optimal performance. How significant is poor sleep among your patient population, with the caveat that this is an area of focus for you?
Yeah, well, poor sleep is rampant. I mean, pretty much sleep is one of the very first symptoms of an imbalance in your adrenal glands, in your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, in your neurochemistry. It may be the first sign of something stimulating your immune system. And this is why, on average, 20% of the people at any given moment in time are not having a very good night's sleep. Every time you wake up, you're going to lose one series of sleep opportunity, one whole entire opportunity of getting extra REM sleep. And at the end of the day, it's not the number of hours you sleep, it's the quality of the sleep and the number of REM hours you have, or REM minutes, I should say, that you accumulate over a night. That's why some people are completely able to function at high levels with 6 hours of sleep, because they have the God-given ability, or whatever ability it may be, to get huge amounts of REM sleep. Conversely, though, other people might require 8 or 9 or 10 hours to get the same REM sleep. That's important to note who you are, because if you don't respect your body's needs, you will have a problem. Likewise, you might want to look at, if you are that person that requires that 8 to 10 hours of sleep or more to recuperate fully, you need to get a little neurochemistry and immune workup to see if there's anything that's actually preventing you from initiating that good sleep that is treatable.
I think that's a really important factor, as I'm sure we both see this in practice. We get people that are like, oh, I just need a lot of sleep. And the question is why? Right? The body knows it thrives when it's awake. And especially if you have 10 hours of sleep and then you're not, you haven't recovered. How do you get them to sleep?
How do I get them to sleep? Well, sometimes I give them a taped lecture of mine and have them listen to it. When it comes to getting people to turn their brain off and sleep, especially with people who have a driver mentality, it's sometimes hard to turn off sort of like the areas in the brain that are constantly worrying and thinking. So those areas we kind of measure with a neurotransmitter assessment. I mean, you can see phenylethylamine, the neurotransmitter, being really high in these type of people. You can see higher norepinephrine levels in these sort of people. Conversely, when that phenylethylamine or norepinephrine or other stimulatory neuromarkers are elevated, it's usually at the expense of some inhibitory or calming neurotransmitter like serotonin. And so we will always measure these levels to make sure that there is no fundamental reason behind some neural imbalance behind sleep issues. Secondly, we look at the overall health. Many people, once again, have gastrointestinal problems, and their gastrointestinal issues actually worsen through the day. By nighttime, those GI issues have manifested in a significant increase in immune activity, which results in inflammation, which results in neural alterations, and that often will lead to the insomnia itself. So we kind of take a little a picture there. I, in addition to that, hey, you know, my mind's not closed to all other issues that can cause problems, and that's why, you know, we look at autoimmune issues, chronic inflammatory, acute inflammatory markers, nutritional status, and things on that order also.
How big do you think the influence of screen time is for these people with chronic sleep issues?
I would say it's a little overrated. And that may be to a collective sigh among your audience. Blue screen is definitely not good, and if you have sleep issues, you don't want to be exposing yourself for 1 or 2 hours before sleep with a blue screen. You definitely don't want to pull your device next to your bed and use it if you wake up in the middle of the night. Those are all things that will reinforce patterns. At the same token, they become more of an impact if you're more susceptible to alterations due to imbalances in your neurotransmitters. So if just looking at a screen is going to make it so you have sleep issues, that usually means that was the last straw that broke the camel's back, that your neural imbalances really are probably more profound and symptomatic. That's probably the main key. Otherwise, especially with our modern lifestyle, and if you are an entrepreneur doing wearing 30 different hats for your company or consultant firm, then you are attached to mobile devices. And so you're not going to detach, because guess what? You wouldn't be able to pay their bills. So that's not a good thing.
Right. And I think there's this fine balance too of just, you know, honoring what your physiology, your body might need. And I really try to encourage the individuals that I'm working with to just like set an alarm on your phone and like just it's done at 9:30 at night, for example. Stick it in airplane mode and read a book on paper, right?
You know, my wife has been a good influence on me. She made sure the bedroom is a Bluetooth and blue screen free zone. She even pronounced it with a glowing salt rock in the corner, indicating that this is now sacred ground. And by doing that, that has prevented me from continuing on multitasking to the late night. And because my printed paperback book is on my bedstand, I do get to read it more often.
Yeah, exactly. Right. When you put healthy things in front of yourself, you're more likely to do them. And, you know, I think that's maybe a good segue because, I think one of the things we just don't do is connect to nature. We don't get outside. And it's so vital to our health as humans. As a small segue, I went to a spinning class the other day and it was like the first day it had really been sunny for a few days up here in Toronto. And I walked in at 8 o'clock in the morning and the blinds were pulled and it was pitch black and we were in this bat cave. And I said to people, I'm like, can I open the blinds? And they looked at me like I was some weirdo, not part of their like Taipei spin class. And I opened the windows anyways, and everyone instantly smiled. You could see the health on their faces. So we need to connect to nature. And I want to segue this into something that I know you're particularly passionate about. And I talk about this a fair bit, and it's a little bit off topic from what we're talking about. But if people are getting outside, we have this epidemic in the northeast part of North America in particular, and that's Lyme disease. How big a problem is this? If people are like, fine, I'm going to go out, I'm going to get into nature, I'm going to go hiking. What do they need to be aware of? What is Lyme disease? Why are you and I both so concerned about it? And should people be paying attention?
Well, Lyme disease is a huge issue. Lyme disease is the number one tick-borne vector disease in the world. In North America, U.S. and Canada, the rates are skyrocketing. I had originally started my practice in New Hampshire in the northeast of the U.S., and right around the year 2000, it became very aware that there were a lot more cases of Lyme disease that were being advertised by our government. And that many people, this has been going on for a long time, and many people's diagnoses were missed. And that awareness started spreading. This awareness has led to, back a few years ago, the Center for Disease Control here in the United States stopped 2 5-year studies. These were studies that they had commissioned to look at the true incident rate of Lyme disease. After the 5-year studies were stopped after 2 years because the data was so profound that they issued a statement indicating that their annual incident rate in the U.S. For Lyme disease, which historically had been between 30 and 32,000 new cases a year, had to be corrected, and that they believe that they underestimated the true incidence rates by a factor of 10 to 13, putting Lyme disease at a new incident rate of about 320,000 new cases every year. And this has been going on since the 1970s. And so it's very, very important for all of us to be aware that Lyme disease has been around for a long time. It has been missed for a very long time. And due to many factors that we don't understand, the ticks that spread Lyme disease are spreading and becoming more virulent. And therefore, our rates of getting the disease are increasing. And the scope of the problem, the territory that these ticks are ravaging, are growing at a faster rate than anyone ever imagined they would.
Can we, I have one last question before we jump into the second half of the interview. Can you give me your definition of health?
My definition of health is the ability to accomplish everything you want.
Short and succinct, but that's so true. You know, I say to people, I do what I do because I believe that when people are well, they can change the world. They can live their mission. And that's really why, that's why I get up in the morning. So I really resonate with that. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. This month, we're focusing on digestion. Why? Because it is the center of everything that happens with respect to your health. It's also something that we rarely like to talk about with our friends or colleagues. So we thought we'd put it in a quiz for you so you can have an understanding as to whether or not your bowel movements, digestion, and the way you are feeling are common or normal or amazing. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/anthropology quiz. The second half of our interview are really what I call KPIs, or key performance indicators. We use these in startups to really understand whether we're on track, and I think they're really important with respect to health. So these are really quick answer questions, and I just want you to give me the first thing that comes to mind. The first question for you is, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share it?
Do I have a consistent morning routine, you asked? Okay. Yes, I do. I wake up. I will blend coconut milk into coffee, into a blender, and I will drink it. I typically will, in the spring and summer and fall months, I go for a run, and then I will shower and go to work. I typically, while I'm drinking coffee, go through my emails and my patient schedule prior to running. That's my morning schedule.
Hot beverage of choice. Is that your coconut oil and coffee, or is it something else?
Yeah, heavy coconut cream and blended in with coffee.
And are you specific about what coffee you use?
No, but I have moved from dark roast to medium roast.
What do you do for fun or play?
Run, swim, and garden.
Last question for you. Entrepreneurism. Are we born this way, or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I think it's both. I think some people are born drivers, and they are always looking for an opportunity. I believe that there are some people who are reluctantly become entrepreneurs because they had the ability to be in the right place, the right time, had a good idea, and the momentum actually sweeps them up. Now, I think that there's case examples of very successful people both ways. So I think in general, a lot of people believe that they're born entrepreneurs, but they might not have all the skill sets. At the same time, a lot of people feel like they're too introverted and can't become an entrepreneur, but they many times they can learn the skill sets and get over some of the social anxieties and become them.
Great answer. When people have got that mission and that passion for what they want to do, they can usually find all the skills they need to get there. Dr. Bush, this interview has been really enlightening for me, and it's been so practical and I think relatable for so many people. Where can people find out more about what you are up to?
Oh, sure. Well, I have two websites. I have my clinic website, which is www.stillwaternatural.com. And I also have a direct-to-consumer website that I offer brain and gut testing and interpretations for, and that is www.neurovana.com, where we offer some of the testing that we talked about with the 4-point cortisol urinary neurotransmitter testing and a test that we use to evaluate presence of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Those are the places that you could reach me, and feel free to check out the websites and ask any questions you have also through the online contact form.
Fantastic. And we'll have all of that information up in our show notes so that everyone can find you and directly link to everything that that you have available to them. And I know that you've also left our listeners with a few little opportunities to try out some of that that testing at a discounted rate. So please head over to meganwalker.com/podcast or theanthropologypodcast.com, where you can learn more about what Dr. Bush is up to. I can't thank you enough for being with us today, notwithstanding a minor interlude of coughing on my side. Yes, NDs get sick too. This was really a fantastic interview and so enlightening. Thanks so much for taking the time.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Anthropology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.